From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we sit down with both candidates for Monroe County District Attorney. It is our one chance to hear from them together in the same room before the election. The race includes the incumbent, Republican Sandra Dorley, who was first elected in 2011. She was a Democrat then. She won re-election in 2015. And her opponent is Democrat in this race, Shawnee Curry Mitchell, a prosecutor with 13 years of experience who worked for 5 years in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office and currently serves as municipal attorney with the city of Rochester. Early voting has begun. Election day is Tuesday, and we appreciate the campaigns making the time. We know in these final 5 days, it is a big push. Schedules are very much packed, and we want to thank them for being here. Republican candidate is Sandra Dorley. Thank you for being here. It's nice to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Evan.
And also with us is the Democrat, Shawnee Curry Mitchell. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to ask both of you to let our listeners and the voters know why you've decided to run for re-election, why Shawnee, why you are running. Sandra, I'll start with you. Why you've decided to run for re-election. Go ahead.
Sure. You know what? After 28 years, I still love the job. I love the effect on public safety. I love what we do for the community. I love being able to bring justice day in and day out for, you know, the many residents of Monroe County. I believe the Monroe County DA's office under my tenure has done some great work, and I'm hoping to continue that for the next 4 years.
Okay, Ms. Mitchell?
Unfortunately, the system is broken, and we are not doing a great job of ensuring the safety of victims and also protecting the rights of individuals that are brought before the court, and we are not connecting with the community. And so we, under the current administration, we can do a better job under, I believe, myself, to better protect the community, protect victims, also address individuals, provide alternatives for those who deserve it, and ensure that those who are brought before the court, their rights are protected, and also protect the community at the same time. So that's why I decided to make this run for district attorney.
Well, I think we can open by extending on that theme and then helping, I think, clarify something that came up in our conversations with both of you separately that happened in the spring. And that was this. Ms. Mitchell, I know you worked in Georgia before coming to Western New York, and you mentioned, for example, in Atlanta as a prosecutor, that when you went to your superiors and felt like there was not sufficient evidence in a case.
Correct.
That you had the discretion to say, we're not going to pursue this. The right thing to do is not to go after it. The goal is not just to win every case, but to seek justice. And sometimes justice says, we don't have the evidence here. And you told us on the program that day that you did not feel that you had that same discretion or same support from your superiors when you worked for Ms. Dorley and for the district attorney's office here.
Correct.
Now, you told us that in 5 years in Monroe County, there was not a single time which a case that you were handling was allowed to be dismissed outright. And the district attorney came on the program subsequently and said that that was false, that there were many, many cases. She was unclear why you would make that allegation. So let's try to clear that up. Let's start there.
So I listened to that, and she gave statistics of cases that were dismissed, right? So cases can be dismissed, and they could be dismissed by a judge, and my name is attached to them. There are situations where victims don't appear for court and they have to be dismissed. We can go into grand jury and we can't move forward because of those reasons that I presented. I gave you a specific scenario where I told you that I didn't feel that I could have that type of discretion to outright dismiss a case. Now in 5 years, I will say that that was not the case for me, as I recall. I know specifically when I tried to go before with my supervisors, I would get the battle that we try to offer them a reduction. Outright withdraw and dismiss was not an option. And that was my experience. Cases get dismissed doesn't necessarily mean that I had the power to withdraw and dismiss. They are dismissed for various other reasons.
Okay, so is it fair to say that your experience in Georgia was very different than your experience here, and here you felt pressured to pursue in some way, even if you felt the right thing to do would be not to pursue a case?
Absolutely.
Ms. Dorley, you want to respond to that?
Thank you. And I would respectfully disagree, because before coming here, actually, Evan, before I came on the radio back in the spring, I did pull up all of Ms. Mitchell's felony case dispositions. And I do have quite a list of cases that were either convicted of lesser counts, were dismissed outright, dismissed in lower court, were no-billed, were pled guilty to lesser counts, were pled guilty to reduced counts, so on and so forth, pages and pages, including some cases that were pled guilty to the top count. So I'm looking at what I have here, this ad hoc report, and it looks like there were a variety of dispositions that were made by Ms. Mitchell, which is very similar to all of the ADAs that are currently in the office. I know there was one case in particular that she did have, you know, a disagreement with her bureau chief. I mean, there's no doubt Ms. Mitchell and her bureau chief did not get along, at least the last one, when she was in the Nonviolent Crime Bureau. And there was one case where they had a disagreement over, you know, what should be charged. There was no doubt that both of them agreed that burglary in the third degree should have been charged, but there was a dispute over whether or not the stolen car should be charged as an unauthorized use of a motor vehicle or a grand larceny in the fourth degree. And what happened was they went to the first assistant, and Ms. Mitchell was able to lay out the reasons why she believed her position was appropriate, and we allowed her to go into grand jury and charge as she will, and I have the indictment in front of me to prove that.
And you know why? Because I stomped and screamed, and I threw out those letters at that word ethical, and they had to back off. I told them that I felt it was unethical to do so because I didn't feel that the evidence supported it. So the fact that I had to fight with my supervisor, then go to the first assistant and throw around words talking about that it violated my ethics. But you should not have to fight like that and throw around words ethical. Ms. Dorley wasn't there, so she can't relate the conversation.
Thank you. I wasn't.
I was. And I was furious. And I had fought with my supervisor over it. And that was not the first time. That was the only one that she knew about because it was relayed to her from the first assistant. But when she's reading you about reductions and things of that nature, I was able to utilize some discretion. With the conversation you and I were talking about, we were talking about a bigger case. We were talking about an armed robbery that I was able to outright dismiss. And I'm telling you, in my experience, that would not have happened. Now, I did not feel that that could happen.
Now, if I could, two points then. If you felt that the office for which you were working was not able to do the ethical thing in certain cases, like you were able to experience in Georgia, and, for example, in this case that you just described, where you are raising your voice with your superior saying, this is violating my ethics, I think a lot of listeners would assume that you would then go to the district attorney's office. You told us on this program that, and I think I'm going to try to quote you because I want to be fair here. You said, I, Shani Karee Mitchell, did not have access to Sandra Dorley.
Absolutely.
And Ms. Dorley told us your door was always open to everyone.
It is always open. It still is. It always has been. In this case, it looks like to review this indictment, they went to the first assistant who supervised the Nonviolent Felony Bureau. And you have to understand, when Ms. Mitchell, I know she did come with experience from Georgia, but when she was hired in the Monroe County DA's office, she had just passed the New York bar. She started out with misdemeanor prosecutions, and then she moved to the Nonviolent Felony Bureau. And there is some degree of supervision because this is the first time these attorneys are working on felony cases. And yes, she was given discretion. But in this case, you know, I know for a fact that, you know, we defer to her judgment.
Okay. And now, do you still feel that it's fair to say that you did not have access to the DA, that you did not feel her door was open?
Absolutely.
Why do you feel that way?
Because I'm not speaking for anyone else.
Okay.
When I tried to, I was not allowed.
To talk to the DA?
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
I did not have that type of access to Sandra Dorley. And I'm just telling you my experience.
Is that fair?
No, it's not. It's probably unfortunate because I have an open door and people just walk in my office all the time. All the time.
Okay. I guess we're going to leave it there, but I will ask you, given that experience, is part of the point you're making, would you run the office differently?
Absolutely. It's a true open door. Yeah. And the thing is, when I came to the DA's office, and I need to be clear, when Ms. Dorley talks about, you know, she was I was in the Nonviolent Felony Bureau, she makes those decisions. It wasn't as if it was some miraculous decision. She makes a decision where every prosecutor is moved to. And the fact that I came with such experience and then I was, and she made the decision of where I would be placed, those decisions came from her. So the fact that I wasn't able to go to another unit is because of a decision that was made directly by Sandra Dorley. Also, I would absolutely have an open door policy. The other offices I had, every prosecutor was allowed to. I would call Mr. Howard, was my first DA. Hey, his secretary, can I get in? Absolutely. Such and such time, such and such date. I would make those calls, and I would not get into Sandra Dorley's office. Plain and simple.
Okay. You want to add to that, Ms. Dorley?
I do. You know, people usually don't call to make an appointment with me. They just literally come in. But again, just getting back to the progression within the office, when Ms. Curry was interviewed for a position in Monroe County DA's office, we explained to her that she would be starting off in local court because she was brand new to New York State. She had just passed the New York State Bar, and she progressed throughout the office as all of our attorneys do. There was nothing extraordinary. There was nothing exceptional. She moved as other attorneys typically do within the office.
And other attorneys in the office did not have the type of experience I had. Also, I had no problem starting off with misdemeanors. I didn't. I didn't expect to sit for 3 years, though, plus years there with 13 years of experience. Also, there are other prosecutors who also went to other bureaus. They didn't go to county court bureau. They might have gone to DWI. They might have gone to sex crimes and other units. They don't have to go to the county court bureau. She chose that for me.
Why do you think, Ms. Dorley, Ms. Mitchell feels that when she spent her 5 years in your office, that yours was an office that essentially did not allow her, and the implication is perhaps other DAs, to not pursue cases, that it was about winning as opposed to about justice? Why do you think she left with that perception?
The only reason I could think is because of the tension between her and her supervisor. But, you know, clearly I have, you know, I've got 80 attorneys who work for me. They all know that, you know, they have the discretion to do what is just. And you know what, Evan, if you look at our numbers, 5,000 felonies and 13,000 to 16,000 misdemeanors on any given year. If I don't give discretion to my attorneys to do what they think is just in each case, how are we going to be able to resolve and get through all of those cases in a court system in any given year?
You told me in the spring, we are not a rubber stamp for police. We have a good balance of dismissing cases that should not go forward.
Absolutely. You know, it's, you know, every week I have risings, grand jury risings. And let me tell you, lately, I feel like the no bill pile is just as high on my desk as the indictment pile. We are not a rubber stamp on police. We are making sure that, first of all, you know, that we're doing the right thing in each case because, you know, there's a lot at stake here. And sometimes we are the last resort for people before they enter into the criminal justice system. But, you know, we've got to look at the case and we've got to look at the evidence. Are we going to be successful? And if we can't even, you know, pass through grand jury, how are we going to be successful at trial? That case needs to be no-billed.
And I would ask that when you're looking at a no bill pile, is it because the victim doesn't show up? Is it for other reasons, not because the officer has done something wrong or we don't have sufficient evidence to make the case? I would say look at those facts. Also, in the misdemeanor section, which is has the heaviest caseload, where are the statistics about when we are allowed to withdraw and dismiss? I was never able to withdraw and dismiss a misdemeanor.
Do you feel that the office is a rubber stamp for police?
I know that. I'm going to give you this example. We were told before we could move on an obstruction of governmental administration, we had to ask the officer's permission before we did that. That was an instruction by the office under this administration.
You felt that was wrong?
We're legal experts, not officers. We determine if there's sufficient evidence based upon the facts, whether or not there is sufficient evidence for an obstruction of governmental administration. You can ask the officer for clarification on the facts, but you never ask an officer for permission. We determine if there's sufficient evidence to match the law.
Giving the police too much power. Is that policy?
It isn't policy. The policy is transparency. The policy is if we are going to dispose of obstructing governmental administration, and I'll even add in resisting arrest, that we notify law enforcement and we let them know why we're doing this, because we want it to be an educational experience for them to say, you know what, we're not going forward because we're missing, you know, X, Y, and Z. That's the reason for it. It's not getting the okay from law enforcement. It's the communication with law enforcement. It's the transparency there.
Does that clear that up for you?
No, it does not. That was not the instruction we were given when I was in the misdemeanor section in 2003, 2013, 14, and 15. I know what I was instructed to do. And that is a twist on the instruction that I was given. And we were outraged that we would have to do that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Mitchell. Please, go ahead.
But we had no recourse. We were told to do it, and our supervisor told her that it came down from Sandra Dorley, and there was no recourse to it.
Right, and that's unfortunate, because that's not the essence of why it was done. It's for communication with law enforcement. We are their partners. We're with them each and every day. If we all of a sudden are dismissing their charges, it's not going to help them if we don't tell them why we're not going forward. So we need that open communication. And, you know, that's a case where I only, you know, wish that Ms. Mitchell would have felt comfortable coming to my office if she had an issue with that.
And I'm going to tell you when it happened. It was specifically after Daryl Pearson was murdered. So it was strategic in that, because we were showing allegiance. And I don't have a problem with, listen, officers work hard, and they have very dangerous jobs. And it is important that we are there to ensure, to work with them and ensure their safety. I didn't have a problem, but asking permission is where you draw the line.
Well,
educating as to why this arrest is not legally sufficient would have been perfect, but that is not the instruction we were given, and we had to execute, plain and simple. And that, I'm telling you right now, that is not correct.
Okay. Let me then ask about a police accountability board, because this community is having a debate about police accountability right now, a rigorous one. Obviously, voters are helping decide. Ms. Dorley, do you want to see this go forward, this new police accountability board for Rochester?
You know, I do not. I believe that the Rochester police are in the best position to police themselves. I know their PSS section is very robust in making sure that, you know, they do review police conduct, whether it be excessive force allegations or illegal conduct allegations. And I know that, you know, at least with the communication that I've had with them, that they have policed their own. They have let people go when they felt that they weren't holding themselves to the standards of a Rochester Police Department. So I believe that the police department is in the best position to police themselves.
And in the matter of policing themselves, yesterday we had a conversation with the police locust club, Mike Mazzeo, the president of the union, along with some of the coalition that wants to see this PAB. And they had a strong disagreement on cases like Christopher Pate. They said that's an example where the police need to admit someone did wrong. Did the police do wrong in that incident with Christopher Pate?
I believe there was excessive use of force in that case, absolutely. But you have to understand there's a use of force continuum that's allowable under law. And it came down to a very specific and nuanced legal issue. Where on that spectrum did it go wrong? What force would they have been able to use? And how did they, at what point did they go beyond that? And again, that's where you need someone, if you're going to have this police accountability board, you need someone on that board who has that expertise.
Yeah, and so the union president, Mike Mazzeo, disagreed with that particular aspect. He said he did not see an excessive use of force. He told us this on the program yesterday, which is what has prompted the coalition to say, can we then trust you to police yourselves? Does that concern you?
Well, think about what they did. I mean, they immediately, upon review of that body camera, they turned it over to my office. And
so you're saying the system worked?
The system worked, and then I put it into grand jury. Well, not myself, but my office put it into grand jury. And, you know, I believe the right charge came out, and ultimately that charge was sustained by a court.
Okay. Do you want to see Ms. Mitchell, the Police Accountability Board, go forward?
So, as you stated earlier, I am a municipal attorney.
Yeah.
And I work specifically with police discipline is my current position. So I can't tell you if I agree or disagree with that with the Police Accountability Board going forward, but I do recognize that there is a disconnect with the community and police, and there is a need for citizens to feel like they're part of the process. They are part of a current process, with the Civilian Review Board. I do believe that the DA's office should play its part in being more transparent in how they review the cases that do come from whatever process comes out of, either the Police Accountability Board or the current process that it has. And that is why I propose a public integrity unit. Erie County has such. The office that I came out of, in Fulton County DA's office, had a public integrity unit. It worked by providing such transparency of cases that would come for review in such nature. And it wasn't just for law enforcement. It was for all of such public trust violation crimes.
The district attorney is saying that in her experience, watching certain incidents play out, watching the way the police respond, interacting with them, that her assessment is right now the PAB is unnecessary. The police are policing themselves rather effectively. Do you agree with that statement?
Again, I work, my current position is with that system, so I can't, as a conflict of interest, comment on that. Do you understand what I
do.
I mean?
No, I think that's perfectly fair.
Okay.
I understand. Ken writes to the program and says, when the DA's office attempts to recruit minority candidates fresh out of law school, what are the requirements for the job, including GPA and class standing, top 10% or something else? I ask this because the office has a minuscule percentage of persons of color in the office, and the majority of people they prosecute seem to be persons of color. District Attorney Dorley.
Yes, I would love to have a more diverse staff. Absolutely, 100%. And I think, you know, Ms. Mitchell will agree with that because she knows that I've sent her to recruiting fairs at least for 2 years while she was on staff trying to make our staff more robust. Unfortunately, you know what? When I look for people, I want the best person who's going to be, you know, a prosecutor. Not many people want to be public servants anymore. You know, I looked at the diversity on my staff. It's roughly now at 8%. I called over to the public defender. His diversity is relatively at the same. It's at 10%. It's very difficult to attract people of color if they're excellent candidates. They're going to be taken by, you know, large law firms, who are able to offer them a lot more money. Our starting salary is $62,000. You know, and I feel that if they're an excellent candidate and they go to a large law firm, they're going to be making twice that immediately. So it is very challenging to get candidates, period, whether they be candidates of color or just candidates, period. A lot of people just don't want to work in government anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Mitchell.
I'm not sure of what recruiting fairs she sent me to because I didn't attend any recruiting fairs for
Shawnee, we sent you and Destiny Bowman
to the National Black
Bar Association. So if I said recruiting fairs, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. I was going to say let's clear that.
Okay. So let me.
That's my. I
called it the wrong thing. Go ahead.
But the purpose was to recruit.
Okay. You don't believe the purpose was to recruit?
So the National Black Prosecutors Association is an organization of prosecutors of color. Destiny Bowman and I were sent for 2 years. They have a job fair there. We asked specifically if we could participate in the job fair. They have a separate job fair. We were told no. We were told no. And Destiny Bowman can vouch for that. So to say that we went for recruiting, we went to attend the conference to bring back information, okay, about how to prosecute various crimes and things like that. It was not to go and recruit because they had a job fair for that. And we were asked, can we take information and specifically recruit? And we were told no.
Is that correct or incorrect?
That is simply not true.
Well, then Destiny Bowman and I are obviously must have a problem with recollection because we definitely were told no.
But who told you no?
Sandra Dorley. We emailed her and asked her directly, could we do that? And we were told no.
That is simply not true.
Okay.
The purpose for sending you, I believe it was to Chicago and then maybe Arizona, was to actually
It was
recruit.
Not Chicago. No.
I don't remember where they were. Okay. I know that, you know, it cost us a lot of money. The purpose was to recruit.
Okay. So you're laughing, but the broader implication seems to be that you don't think the current DA's office cares much about diversity in the office.
Obviously not. And so it doesn't. And there were opportunities to hire a Cornell law grad and a Harvard law grad who was an intern in the office, and they punted on that opportunity to hire one who wanted to be a public servant who was of color. So people come to the DA's office because we want trial experience and we want to serve. That is correct. But you have to go to places where people of color are, and you have to be consistent. We were sent twice to that particular conference. We were told no, and then we were told we weren't able to go anymore after that. So, plain and simple.
Well, now, what would you do differently?
Recruit where people of color are. There are law firms, excuse me, there are law schools just for people of color. Okay? They're historically black law firms. Historically, law schools
yeah.
of color. You can recruit there. You can actually attend the National Black Prosecutors Association and utilize the job fair like other prosecuting offices did. You can do that as well. And you can consistently recruit with the associations of black associations that are, and also not just black, but Asian law student associations, Hispanic law student associations, actually be where people of color are. Also, differently abled people, right, that are law students. We can recruit there. So by making a true diverse office, that's how you get a better perspective on the law and are able to provide true justice in the DA's office. But you have to be in those places, and you have to go to those places, and you have to be serious about it, and that's how you do it.
Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, I mean, we do the best that we can. We go to all of the local law schools. We try to recruit. We've got a website. We encourage anyone from even out of the area to come and apply to us. And frankly, you know, we look for people who have a tie to Rochester, because when we accept someone, we put in a lot of training. And, you know, we don't want someone to come in from, you know, out of state if they're not willing to stay in the area. But you know what? I welcome, if there's any candidates out there of a diverse background, you know what? I would love applications. I mean, it's my goal to make the office more diverse in any way that I can.
But there's a difference between making it diverse and making it inclusion, making it inclusive. And that's a difference. You have to, once you have people there, you have to make it such an environment that people want to stay. There's a diversity law clerkship here in the city of Rochester that I work with in Monroe County. And they go to firms, but they also go to they go to the private sector or public sector also. That's another way for the office to participate and have diversity too. We just have to be everywhere people of color are and people who are that are differently abled.
I totally agree. And we do participate in that clerkship. Unfortunately, ours are unpaid clerkships.
We're talking to Sandra Dorley, who's the Republican candidate for Monroe County District Attorney, and Shawnee Curry Mitchell, the Democratic candidate. They are in studio with us for the hour here. And we'll get to some of your feedback in just a moment here. I do want to kind of clear up some of the controversy from recent weeks, some heated public debate about a series of ads that are not not from Shawnee Curry Mitchell. They are supporting Shawnee Curry Mitchell. The ads come from a super PAC. And as you might have seen in reporting by Gary Craig in the Democrat and Chronicle, the super PAC is funded by billionaire George Soros. His PAC, by the way, is doing this across the country, as Craig reports. They're targeting prosecutors that they believe are not progressive when it comes to criminal justice measures, decriminalization of marijuana, and they see racial imbalances in jail and prison populations. So here in Monroe County, we know that super PAC has spent more than $800,000 on ads. Based on the math, that's more than 80% of the total spending in the entire race combined here. And Ms. Curry Mitchell, I know those are not your ads, but they certainly would like to see you win. Do you have any problem with this outside entity spending so much on ads in this race?
No.
Do you feel that you'd like to see campaign finance reform in any way?
I believe that everyone should be part of the process, absolutely. From small money donors should feel like they are part of the process, and that's what I've done with my campaign. That's what I've pushed, that this is your campaign. I've made it about the people. But I also am realistic that the way that that the way elections have run, that sometimes the people are not heard. I didn't go soliciting for it. It came to me. And so I can't control what is being done out there. And but the Republicans have had large coffers for many, many years, and no one has said a word about that. And I think it's unfair that I have to be the spokesperson for it now, because it's now someone working on my behalf. No one has said a word when for the billionaires that have been funding Republicans for forever. So now I need to be the spokesperson. But I believe that small donors have been want to be part of the process, and that's the way I've raised my campaign has been for small donors. But somebody has believed in me, in my message of reform. I grew up on the southwest part of the city. I matriculated through city schools. My father and mother were public servants. I'm a public servant. I have made my life about being a public servant. But I actually am honored that someone has thought enough of my ideas for change here in Monroe County. So that's the way I look at it.
Ms. Dorley.
Okay, so where to begin on that? You know, first of all, this is the first time that there's ever been this great a sum of outside money coming into a local election. It's not money from Ms. Curry Mitchell or any of her friends. It's an outside source trying to influence a local election, and I think it's wrong. You know, I've gone out and I've talked to people in the community, and I've raised money from people in the community. I have people in the community who are supporting my reelection. This $800,000 is coming from someone who has no business being in Monroe County. And, you know, it's frustrating. And I dare Miss Curry Mitchell to say that there isn't collusion between her campaign and this PAC. You know, I've got several examples that I can cite that it appears that there's straight collusion, that, you know, she is very well aware of the message of these commercials and who was behind these commercials, and that she was, I'll go so far as to say, a part of these commercials. And that's a violation of the law under the independent expenditure account policies. And
then the Board of Elections, send it to them. They do their investigation, and we welcome all of it. And we've said this before. We've said it, and I stand behind it. Listen, I'm not part of it, never have, and that's all I'm going to say about it. They want me to be part of it because they have nothing else. So it's fine with me. Again, Ms. Dorley can also knows that she has money coming from outside of Monroe County. And she knows that. For her to say that she has no funders from outside of Monroe County is incorrect.
I have one funder. It's $1,000 from one individual.
But you just said you had none.
It's my husband's boss. He has a checking account outside of Florida. He sent me money for my reelection. That's my only outside source. Everything else has come from within Monroe County.
Let me hit a couple other points on this, though. Your party has been the one that supported this kind of, your party, generally speaking, in this country, views this kind of political spending as speech. This is what has been the argument forever, that if you've got money and you want to spend it, that is a form of speech and it ought to be protected. And here we are with Citizens United, which your party supported. And for a long time, when Republicans are benefited by the Kochs, we don't hear Republicans complaining.
Sure.
I hear you complaining now. Is there inconsistency?
Sure. You know what I'm looking at? You know, I'm not talking about what Republicans have done in big elections. I'm talking about a local election for this amount of money.
Would you welcome support from the Heartland Institute, the Koch brothers, if they put in $800,000 to support you?
You know what? No, I would not.
You would not. You would call it out.
I would. You know what? And, you know, I've been raising money here in Monroe County because this is a Monroe County election. Politics in this race are local. They have nothing to do with George Soros. They have nothing to do with the Koch brothers. Politics are local. And again, it's just disheartening that Ms. Curry Mitchell is saying that she was not a part of these commercials. I mean, the photographs that she's used in her campaign are used in the commercial. There are individuals, I call it in her support Shawnee Mitchell campaign, they are purportedly actors and actresses, but they're not. They went on her Facebook and said, no, we are not actors and actresses, sorry, I keep saying that, paid for by the PAC. We are her friends. We are her supporters. And on her Facebook, she even liked that. So she's well aware that the individuals in her in these PAC commercials are her supporters. In fact, the latest commercial that comes out, there's a picture of her at an event and she's smiling. That is, in fact, footage that was taken at one of her fundraisers.
And my events are public.
Anyone can show up.
Anybody can show up to it. This is ridiculous.
And then I'll go one step further. Her digital media has the commercials, and it clearly says supported by the PAC. But underneath on the digital media it says, you know, supported by friends of Shawnee Curry Mitchell. And if you click on that, it takes you right to her Facebook and to her campaign website.
So what the district attorney is talking about is the fact that the law says, and this is something, oddly enough, that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert tried to illustrate, which is that super PACs are supposed to not coordinate with campaigns.
Correct.
And if they don't, they can spend whatever they want, but you cannot have cross-pollination. And she's alleging that there is, and you say not at all.
Absolutely not. And the Board of Elections has done an investigation and said nothing, and there's nothing to it. So I'm not worried at all.
Well, that actually, that's not true. The Board of Elections hasn't even begun to look at it yet.
No,
They
have.
It was sent out last week, and if they've done that investigation within a few days, then that's going to be quite something.
Because there's nothing to it, plain and simple. We haven't broken any laws.
But that's not a decision by the Board of Elections.
I disagree, but I'm not worried.
Okay, and last question on this. Should your supporters appear in videos for this kind of a PAC, that kind of a thing? Is there any concern that who have either volunteered for you, carried signs for you, run petitions for you, if they show up in these kinds of ads, is that a problem for you?
If the law doesn't, if there's no violation of the law, then it's okay.
I got you. So do you want to see the law change?
I'm not. No, I don't believe that there is a problem with the law as it is.
Okay. Do you want to see that law change? About the way outside groups can spend money.
Actually, I'd love to see that change. Absolutely.
Now, one more point before we get to some phone calls. As we talk to Sandra Dorley and Shawnee Curry Mitchell, who are running for Monroe County District Attorney, one of the outspoken critics in this whole episode has actually been a Democrat just elected to the Monroe County Legislature. That's Rachel Barnhart. She also ran for mayor of Rochester, did not win, and has said since that race against Lovely Warren that there would be an investigation and some kind of evidence that the mayor of Rochester had broken laws. And I know you have talked about this. Your office, my understanding is, at least looked at this. Is that investigation ongoing, and are we going to see something from that?
I'm not going to comment at this point. Thank you.
I'll give you the opportunity to say no, or that there is nothing there.
I'm not going to say either one.
Okay. We do know you have made statements in the past that your office would look at it. Is that fair?
I don't believe it's a secret that I've sent out subpoenas
for
the Board of Elections. The matter is under review. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. And if you are elected, Ms. Curry Mitchell, is that the kind of investigation you would continue?
I would hope that that matter will be resolved by the time that I would take the helm.
Okay.
I would hope she will close out whatever pending cases she has.
All right. Let's get to some phone calls. And I'm going to start with, I was going to say John in Rochester. We lost you, John. So Peter in Rochester next. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for your show. And I wanted to comment directly on Ms. Dorley's job performance that I've had. In the fall of, 2017, when Kevin Quander was sentenced, I was broken into by a guy named David Kimber. And Kimber had just gotten out 7 months prior on a rape third. And if you know about that, well, it wasn't a rape third, but what he did. So anyway, we came home from the state fair, and we're down at Park Ave. He's in our house. I had physical contact with Mr. Kimber. Well, we get a call the next thing that it's all been taken care of. We worked out a deal. He got 1 1/3 to 4. These are two violent offenses after Kevin Quandre. So I'm going to say, you think she's doing her job, tough on crime? You look at that case.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm not familiar with the case, and I think it's hard to sort of sit here and adjudicate that. I mean, I'm sympathetic to whatever experience anyone has, but I don't know how to kind of suss that out on the radio.
Right. You know what? And I'd love to be able to help you, but I'm not familiar with that case. Actually, at that time, you're correct. I was prosecuting Kevin Quandre. But I'm not familiar with your facts, sir. There's many different reasons why a plea could have been offered in that case. It could have been, one of many things, but I'm not even going to venture to guess without knowing the facts.
Okay. Let me go ahead and get Kim in Rochester. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, so first of all, I want to say thank you, Evan Dawson, for making ethics a part of this conversation. And my question is for Sandra Dorley. So you speak a lot about your conviction rate, and whereas it is true the numbers do not lie, but the statements surrounding them can manipulate the conversation. For example, the numbers also show that the people you are locking up are nonviolent offenders who are actually in need of resources. Yet, on your social media page, you constantly talk about murders as if those are the majority of the people you are locking up. And I'd like to know why you are doing that.
Oh, okay.
Great. You know what? I'm not. Let me start with this. The Monroe County population, the jail, maximum capacity is 1,600. We have consistently been 12 to 1,300. We are now down in the 900s, which means there are less people being housed in the Monroe County Jail. And I could tell you it's because we were making smarter choices as to who is being held. And we were making smarter choices and more educated choices as to who is receiving sentences of jail or incarceration. I could tell you, and you know, a lot of my supporters, you know, aren't happy when I say this, but I'm a big proponent in diversion courts. We send a lot of people through diversion courts, especially for nonviolent offenders. And I think if you look at the numbers there, you're going to be seeing that, you know, we've given people the opportunity to go to drug courts. We've, you know, with our gun crimes part, we no longer have a mandatory no plea bargaining out of state prison policy with gun crimes. We now have programs such as interim probation, swift, certain, and fair, and all of our cases go through gun crimes part so that we can, you know, make sure through procedural justice standards that everyone there is treated fairly.
Okay. Do you want to add to that, Ms. Mitchell?
These are court-mandated, court-created diversion programs. I would say that Ms. Dorley, in her 8 years, doesn't have any DA-run diversion programs, which are different. With the DA-run diversion program, you provide, you have more control and over these types of programs or how your cases are resolved. When you have DA-run diversion programs, you are able to decide how an individual's case is resolved and what type of services they can provide. It has not always been a diversion-first philosophy in the DA's office, and I believe that there was some resistance to cases being diverted under the current administration. But having a diversion programs in the DA's office provides a more variety. So, for example, what I would like to do is have a social worker on the staff that would allow for individualized programs to occur for low-level nonviolent offenders. So instead of just drug court, you can have a person to receive treatment for a number of various issues that causes them to offend. Because we all know that offending, the reason why people offend is not just because of one thing. It could be a number of things: lack of education, drug addiction, undiagnosed mental health issues, which is very prominent in for people of color. By having that and crafting individualized programs, you can divert prosecution. And what happens in these drug courts, mental health court, and things of that nature, you have to take a plea first. Opioid court is the only one where you don't have to take a plea first. But by diverting it in-house and crafting these programs, we can do a better job of stopping the revolving door of offending. And we can do that in-house in the DA's office.
Okay. You want to respond to that?
I just do briefly. You know, once an arrest is made, the cases are naturally going before a court. You know what? I would love to have diversion programs where I could bring offenders in, you know, before they commit a crime. That's just not the way the system works. You know, we do have Project Hope, which is a diversion outside of the court system for those who are suffering from substance abuse disorder. And now the new one that I was actually a part of creating for mental health services. So now we are diverting mental health individuals through the St. Mary's program. So law enforcement, instead of arresting them, will bring them right to St. Mary's. So those are the two outside of the court system diversion programs that we have. The rest, you know, we're subject to the constraints of the court because they're after an arrest is made. And I believe the court systems are doing well with the diversion courts. You know, we just, you know, had a press conference the other day about the expansion of the human trafficking court. And Judge Yakutin was very clear to mention that if it wasn't for my agreement and my participation in the court, it wouldn't be successful because if women go through this court, I dismiss the charges.
It's not an accurate statement that once the case is arrested, there's not much we can, the person is arrested or it goes to the court. When we're in court, we can ask the case to be, for the case to be diverted, and the DA knows that, which means that it gives us time to do it. And just like she talked about the case where St. Mary's, these are individuals who are under a type of psychosis at the time. They go to St. Mary's to be treated instead of being arrested because most Sheriff Baxter will tell you that over 50% of people who are in the jail currently they're housing people that are mentally ill, which is a problem. That means that we have to do a better job of addressing people who are mentally ill.
All right. Let me get Michelle's question. I'm sorry. Marsha wants to know, how do the candidates feel about the bail reform changes coming in January? District Attorney Dorley.
Sure. You know what? We're working on all of the changes. I am going to make sure that my staff will be able to handle them seamlessly come January 1st. I mean, it's going to basically change the way that we do business because all of the individuals who are arrested for non-qualifying offenses will be given the presumption of release on your own recognizance. And now for those who are arrested for qualifying offenses, they will have three types of bail set, two including a partially secured and an unsecured bond. So we are going to see more and more defendants out on release pre-trial, which, you know, is fine. The only concern I have is I want to make sure that we can still prosecute cases. I want to make sure that witnesses and victims are still cooperative, that they're not being tampered with, and they're able to show up and come to court so that we can resolve things properly in a court of law.
Okay, Ms. Mitchell?
I believe that the bail reform will address the inequities that have been the bail system. There still will be protection for victims of any harm. Officers can still make an arrest and provide if they believe that an order of protection is necessary. That is written into the law. So we can provide those types of protections for victims. I believe that the system will work. We just have to adjust, and we have to make sure we educate our staff to those changes.
These changes were necessary, you think?
We know that there were inequities in the system, so yes, I would say.
Do you agree that there were inequities in the system?
You know, in some areas, yes. But, you know, I know that, you know, in Monroe County, I was looking at the jail census, and I have been for the last couple of years. And, you know, we don't have people being held in Monroe County Jail on low bail, unless that low number is because they have another hold. As I said, we're making smarter choices. The jail population has steadily declined over the last couple of years.
But we know that in the towns, more often than not, people who were being held on bails that should not have been. And I think that maybe city court judges address the issue better than maybe our town court judges. And that's where mostly we saw the inequities.
All right, I'd
agree with that.
About 30 seconds apiece. Your website for your campaign is what?
SandraDorley.com.
And Shawnee Curry Mitchell, your website is?
ShawneeCurryMitchell.com.
And Shawnee is S-H-A-N-I, ShawneeCurryMitchell.com. 30 seconds, final remarks that you want voters to think about as they head to vote in the next few days.
Sure. You know what? I think experience matters. You know, as district attorney for the last 8 years, and as being a prosecutor here in Monroe County for 28 years, experience really matters. As your district attorney, you have to wear three hats. You have to be the chief law enforcement officer. I have the support of all law enforcement in this community. You have to be the chief trial attorney. I've been able to do that. I've successfully prosecuted, you know, hundreds of trials, and I've prosecuted close to, you know, 40, 50 homicides and overseen 500 homicides on my own here in Monroe County. And you've got to be the chief CEO of this company. This is a 140-person law firm. We are the fifth biggest law firm in the area, managing a budget of close to $16 million. Thank you.
Ms. Green Mitchell.
Experience does matter, but you would need to make sure that that experience has not contributed to the system being broken. And I'm going to tell you that the system is broken. We have the tools to fix it, and we want to ensure that we have someone who has the courage to fix it. I'm telling you, with the 20 years of experience that I have the tools to fix it, but we need to work together. I will protect victims. I will ensure that people who harm individuals are prosecuted, and I will protect the public resources and fairly and effectively.
I want to thank both of our guests. You just heard the Democrat, Shawnee Curry Mitchell, running for Monroe County District Attorney. Thank you very much, Ms. Mitchell, for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Sandra Dorley is the Republican running for Monroe County District Attorney. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for the opportunity.
And just a reminder to listeners, if you want to kind of catch a replay or share it on Facebook Live, we can do that. We appreciate that as well. Thanks to the entire team for helping out this hour with the candidates for Monroe County District Attorney. More connections coming up.